From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michiganders head to the polls as county clerks keep a watchful eye.
I was visiting a few precincts this morning, and there were steadily moving lines, which is what we like to see.
We are seeing a high turnout. We're seeing lines, and thankfully people are staying in them, but people are engaged in Oakland County this election day.
NASA's historic solar probe moving faster than any man-made object ever.
That fastest approach in 7 years, it'll be moving at around 430,000 miles an hour. So New York to Philadelphia in like 1 second.
And West Michigan music from Conrad, Shock and the Noise.
They're a really fun band to watch live. And I think that if folks hear them, it'll be one of those things where they'll go, oh, I've got to hear more about this band.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All signs point to intense voter interest and a heavy turnout across Michigan on this election day. We wanted to see how things are going, so we're starting in West Michigan, in Ottawa County, where Justin Roebuck is county clerk. And you say you're an election nerd, and that's a good thing for a clerk, Justin. How has the day been in terms of turnout across your precincts?
Indeed. This is the kind of stuff we live for as election administrators, and it's been a good day. We've had a really strong showing thus far, just anecdotal reports that we're getting from the precincts. I was visiting a few precincts this morning, and there were steadily moving lines, which is what we like to see. Of course, at 7 o'clock, there's always going to be that first initial rush, but things have pretty much remained steady through the day, which is definitely an indicator of strong turnout.
And what about absentee ballots? What's the rate of return been like for you?
So we are just a little bit under the number of absentee ballots that were issued in 2016. And so that's impressive for a midterm election. And that would tell me right there that we've got, you know, a strong turnout in the works for this election. Over 15% of our voters have already been issued an absentee ballot. As of last night, there are about 2,000 left to be returned, and likely those are going to be returned throughout the day today.
Justin, critics of the law that ended straight ticket voting in Michigan fought it all the way to the Supreme Court and lost. And they predicted the change would cause a lot of confusion and delay in the polling places on Election Day. Are you seeing that in Ottawa County?
Well, I think that was our biggest concern going into today. Really, it's an unknown factor. Ottawa County has used that historically at a really high rate. 60% of our voters in 2014 used that straight party option. 55% used it in the presidential last cycle. So for us, we were concerned, you know, about the line issue. When you think about, you know, voters are now having to choose potentially up to 16 or 18 additional vote marks that are going to have to be made, additional decisions on those individual candidates as they go down the ballot. What we are seeing currently, anecdotally, is that that's not affecting our lines at a dramatic rate, at least as of yet. And, of course, typically the largest lines come first thing in the morning at 7 o'clock. So part of that is preparation. What we've done is to make sure that our voters have, you know, adequate voting booths, that the clerks have provided, you know, one voting booth per 80 voters. That's been our recommendation. So the law allows for one voting booth per 300. So we expanded the quantity of the voting booths. With the ideal situation is that there's more room for more voters as they're taking a little bit longer time filling those ballots out.
You got enough ballots? Are we hearing about spoiled ballots?
Yeah, I mean, in a large election, typically we do get a very small percentage of spoiled ballots. Typically, and it's a bigger percentage in a larger election than it is a small election, obviously. You know, we say our regular customers, right, are those customers that are come and vote at the small school election, at the off-year city election. And sometimes when you get the newer voters in, there's just a bigger learning curve. And so we kind of prepare for additional spoiled ballots. So we ordered 110% of our registered voter total countywide. And so that accommodates for, you know, our legal requirement to have 100% of ballots on hand, but also to make sure that we're covering additional voters who register by the deadline and also spoiled ballots. So we're pretty confident that we've got, you know, enough ballots in the precincts to be prepared for any eventuality there.
Ottawa County Clerk Justin Roebuck, thanks so much for talking with us, Justin.
You bet. It's good to be with you.
We head over to Southeast Michigan, now to Oakland County, as we say hello to Oakland County Clerk Lisa Brown. Lisa, what kind of turnout are you seeing across the county?
We are seeing a high turnout. We're seeing lines, and thankfully people are staying in them, but people are engaged in Oakland County this election day.
And what about absentee ballots? How's the rate of return been?
Well, actually, we just got a report from the state. You know, there's still some ballots out there. Actually, I had one that was delivered to my office, which it should have gone to the local clerk. I'm going to be delivering that to a local clerk after I hang up with you. They didn't put a return address on there. So we still have some outstanding ballots out there. I know that as far as the absentees, and hopefully they'll come in before 8 p.m. today.
There is talk that this year's turnout could top the 2016 presidential election. Are you seeing that at all in Oakland County?
I think it's too early for us to be able to, you know, tell that, but we definitely have a high turnout. Definitely, you know, more than we had in 2014.
Now, the primary election in August brought out a record number of voters. And as you know, that caused problems with some precincts in Oakland County running out of ballots and some very, very long lines. And I know after the problems on primary day, you were quoted in the Detroit Free Press as saying you were baffled by the ballot shortages. You were going to investigate. What did you find? What happened?
Well, we actually had ordered and printed 430,000 ballots. We had 324,000 voters. What we had were a record number of spoiled ballots. We had where we should have been seeing 1 to 2% spoilage, we had a precinct as high as 22% spoiled ballots. We had a precinct that had 75 spoiled ballots. We had voters that took 5 ballots before they got it right. So it was an education issue. I mean, we definitely had higher turnout, and we definitely, and in a couple of precincts, we definitely had high turnout that we frankly did not print that many ballots for. But I don't think anyone could have expected some of the turnouts that we had in some of our precincts.
So what did you learn from primary day that's been applied today?
Well, again, for the law, you know, we follow the law, and the law requires us for November to print one ballot for every voter. Whether, you know, you only vote in presidentials or whatever, it doesn't matter. A ballot has been printed for you. And we've actually went a little bit over 100% just to make sure. But we shouldn't see those spoilage issues that we see in August because, you know, people were crossing party lines in August. Obviously, you can do that in November.
Now, any hiccups that you know of today with either the process or the machines?
Well, not our machines, but maybe user error, I guess I would say, that we've had some who haven't checked to make sure that it's connected to electricity, so they were relying on the battery, not knowing that the surge protector was off, the power strip was off. So they went down for, you know, a bit, those sorts of things where we're just seeing kind of human error, you know, when it comes to the setup and that sort of thing.
What do you want to be able to say when you finally close up shop late tonight?
Well, I hope it's not too late. But I hope that everyone who wanted to vote had the opportunity to vote. I want to remind people as long as they're in line by 8 o'clock, they have the right to vote, even if it's after 8 o'clock by the time they get their ballot. You know, the main thing, that everybody who wanted to vote had the opportunity to vote and have their voice be heard.
Oakland County Clerk Lisa Brown, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Detroit artist Brendan Patrick lost his vision and nearly his life to cystic fibrosis. Now he's making the most of the time he's been given by creating art and raising awareness of his disease. Michigan Radio's Catherine Schaefer reports.
At first glance, Brendan Patrick's studio looks like any artist's studio. It's full of paints, supplies, and canvases filled with bright colors. But look a little closer and you'll see everything is labeled in Braille. Brendan is banging a jar of red paint against his desk to get the lid open.
Mm-hmm.
He's wearing paint-splattered overalls and dark sunglasses. He's showing us his technique.
Dip my paintbrush in some paint, and I just kind of follow the line with my left hand while the brush is in my right hand. And the key is, hopefully I stay in the lines. We'll see if that happens. Well, you guys will see if that happens.
Brendan lost his vision a decade ago. Before that, he was a tattoo artist. And in his free time, he learned to play the guitar and started a band, all while living with a serious illness, cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis causes progressive damage to the lungs. Brendan was in the hospital repeatedly. By the time he was 26, it seemed like his time was up. In 2008, he spent 5 months in intensive care waiting for a lung transplant.
While I was on my ventilator, all I was doing was painting 24/7. I probably painted maybe 100 paintings. I was in the ICU in my own private room, and it looked like an art gallery.
Brendan's lung transplant was a success, but he had a rare complication. He lost his vision. Rob Cousineau is a longtime friend of Brendan's, and he's filming a documentary about him. He remembers the aftermath of Brendan's devastating loss.
Brendan has all of this time now gifted to him with this new lung transplant, and he can't see, so he has nothing to do with the time he has left.
Brendan's friends and family stood by helplessly as he spiraled into depression. This went on for about 2 years. Then a friend suggested he use puffy paint to outline his designs, and that got him painting again. Something really interesting happened to Brendan's art after he was blind. A new style emerged on the canvas.
I can create rooms in my brain. I can create images, and I can kind of paint a person's face that I've never seen.
10 years later, Brendan's style is basically the same as it was before he was blind. It's full of bright colors and characters from horror and science fiction, but there's something different about it now. Like, you're seeing directly into Brendan's mind. And people love it.
Some of the stuff he does, it's ridiculous how good it is for the fact that he's blind. You can see that he's blind. The stuff all just works.
That's another artist, Evan Stazopoulos, at a fundraiser for cystic fibrosis featuring Brendan's art. Dozens of artists are painting blindfolded in Detroit's Tangent Gallery, trying to copy Brendan's process. They're doing this for the first time, and it's mostly going hilariously wrong for them. Tucked away in a corner, Brendan sits on the floor with his paints and canvases. He says he's painting a fluffy bunny rabbit. It's grotesque and cute. He makes it look easy. Brendan's not exactly grateful he lost his vision, but he is having a lot of success because of it.
It moves some paintings, so that's positive, right? But, I mean, with that being said, you know, my story isn't really about me dwelling on all my misfortunes. It's more what I've done after.
And what he's done after is create a tremendous amount of art and music. Most people think they have plenty of time to accomplish their goals in life. Brendan's gift is that he's never taken his time for granted. I'm Catherine Schaefer.
Later in the show, we revisit the eventful elections of Michigan's past. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And time again to check in on the West Michigan music scene as we say hello to journalist and music critic John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com. And we're going to dive right in, John, beginning with Conrad Shock and the Noise and their track, Outside the Dream. So, John, tell us about this band. They met at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids.
Yeah, they've been together for a few years, and the first time I heard them, I knew there was something different about them. It's one of those rock bands that once you hear them, you'll never forget them. They sort of put together very catchy, hyper-catchy songs that kind of get planted in your brain, and so you can't get them out of there. Well, I hope I don't lose my mind. Conrad Shock, also known as frontman John Conrad Shock, is the leader of this bunch, and they released their debut album in 2017 and then their self-titled sophomore album just last month. And their music's gotten a little more psychedelic, I'd say, over the last couple of years, but there's still this undercurrent of bluesiness, and they'll say that their songs are influenced by everything from Father John Misty to the Velvet Underground. But they're a really fun band to watch live, and I think that if folks hear them, it'll be one of those things where they'll go, oh, I've got to hear more about this band.
So where can people see them? Do they have any dates coming up?
They just had their album release show here in Grand Rapids, but they'll be playing Speakeasy Lounge in Grand Rapids on December 19th, and then Ethanology up in Ilk Rapids on December 22nd.
All right, run up to Christmas. All right, next up, a band of brothers in every sense of the word, Brother Elsie?
Yeah, quite literally a band of brothers. I just had these guys in studio with me, and they are so much fun because they grew up together, obviously. They've been playing music together since they were 10 or 11 years old.
So they're really brothers.
They really are. Brady, Jack, and Bo Stabline, they go by Brother Elsie. They grew up, like I say, in the Detroit area, but they decided to move to Grand Rapids last year because they saw that the folk rock and Americana and kind of roots rock scene here is really getting big, and they decided that this was a really good place for them, as they put it, a place to shine and a time to shine. They just released this single called Taker, and they'll plan to release more singles, and they're going to continue to tour throughout the Midwest over the next year.
All right, let's take a listen to some of Taker from Brother Elsie.
I can notice, so if you're faking it, you know I was a taker myself. With all of my awesomeness, building a better life, with my books kept clean on shelf.
What do you think this band does best, John?
It's amazing because I had these guys open for another band not long ago at my Speakeasy Lounge series, and I had all these people coming up to me during the show and afterwards telling me how great they were. And part of it is, as soon as they open their mouths and start singing and playing their music, they're very tight. They have those wonderful sibling harmonies, although they'll say it took a long time to pull those together. They really have that wonderful rootsy sound, and their stuff is really infectious. They're playing in Davenport, Iowa, actually, this coming weekend, but I know they're setting up some more dates over the next several months, so I know they're going to be performing here in Michigan, definitely into 2019.
All right, now we move to Jake Simmons and The Little Ghost. Where is Jake Simmons from, and how does he describe his music?
So originally, he's from Coloma, southwest Michigan, but he's now based in Kalamazoo. And he likes to think of it as, like, quote, big, loud rock and roll. But I hear a lot more rootsiness to this. I hear sort of this Midwestern sound. There's some country twang involved. They'll call it a mix between Blue Collar Springsteen and that hold steady kind of sound. He formed the band Jake Simmons and the Little Ghost way back in 2010. So this is their third full-length album. It's called Shake So Easy. And this was the first single off of the album. It's called Movies.
They're out on a Midwest tour supporting this new album. Any Michigan dates planned?
Yeah, they will probably be playing Michigan later on this year, but they're really hitting the Midwest hard. They're playing Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison, St. Louis, Cleveland, and several other cities. They're going to be making some stops closer to home, November 17th at Holland House in Toledo, and December 7th at Ghost Light in Hamtramck.
All right, so just to recap, Jake Simmons and the Little Ghosts out with their third album, Shake So Easy. We talked about Brother Elsie. Their new single is Taker. And we began with Conrad, Shock, and the Noise out with their self-titled sophomore album. You can learn more about these and all these other artists with West Michigan roots by going to localspins.com, which, of course, is edited and published by my guest, John Sinkovich. It's always fun, John. Thank you so much.
It's great taking a respite from all those election campaign commercials.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. It has been a long and fervid run-up to today's midterm elections, and maybe you find yourself cheering the end of candidates, trading punches and robocalls, mailers, and nonstop political commercials. And perhaps you're wondering, has it always been like this, or were elections less contentious back in the day? The short answer, nope. We took a walk through Michigan's colorful election history with Detroit historian Mickey Lyons, who runs the blog ProhibitionDetroit.com. We sat down at our recent live show in Ann Arbor. So you're going to take us in the time machine, and we're going to go back. Let's go back first to 1896, when Hazen Pingree, Potato Patch Pingree, was elected governor. What went down then?
All right, so Hazen Pingree has consistently been voted one of the best mayors in American history. He is a god among mayors, truly is. But he was Detroit mayor and did a fantastic job at that. He then was elected governor of the state of Michigan. Being very good at his job, he decided, well, I can do both. And said, I can do both, right? And a bunch of people said, yeah, you can be mayor and governor at the same time. That's fine. And he took it all the way up to the state Supreme Court of Michigan. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do both. So you need to have a runoff election. And that's where things got a little bit weird.
What happened?
So he sort of hand-selected his replacement. And by this point, this is Republicans and Democrats fighting against each other.
Oh, surprise.
Yeah, right? Big business versus the little guy versus the unions. And as it turns out, Pingree's selected replacement just basically went campaigning and said, well, Pingree picked me, so vote for me, yay. And his opponent, William Cotter Mayberry, who just sort of happened to be kissing cousins with Henry Ford, was the opponent and said, vote for me. I'm a good guy. I kiss babies. I like business. Let's do this. So it turned into this thing between Pingree, who was formerly the big business opponent, really having to step back, and in the end, Pingree's chosen replacement lost.
Lost.
Yes.
You lost.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's as if Mike Duggan ran for governor and got elected and said, by the way, I want to still be Detroit's
right.
mayor.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Let's go further back in time. Hamtramck, 1840. Tell us about the Hamtramck affair.
The Hamtramck affair. It sounds so much more sordid
yes.
and dirty, especially when you consider the fact that Hamtramck at the time was really everything east of the Renaissance Center and going northwards from there. So this is a great swath of territory in eastern Detroit. So in 1840, this is the Whigs versus the Democrats, because the Republican Party doesn't exist yet. And the ballot box for the state representative disappears.
Vanishes.
Well, it turns out the township clerk, Louis Moran, ran into his buddy, John Mack, who was the ballot inspector, and they decided to go to the tavern, like you do at the end of a very long election day. And they went to the tavern together, and they got very, very, very drunk. And the next morning, the ballot box for state representative turned up in the middle of the road, found by a merchant on his way to the market, destroyed with the ballots strewn about. So that was the Hamtramck affair. 334 ballots in all, completely lost and destroyed.
After a drunken night out.
Yes.
Which leads us to kind of touch on the role that alcohol and bartenders have played in politics in Southeast Michigan. And so what kind of role can we explore with that?
Back in the day, it's not hard to imagine, back in the day, your bartender was an integral part of your life. He taught you how to vote. He was your banker. He was your confidant. He was your confessor. He was your friend. And your bar life was your social life. So the people that owned the big taverns were really not only socially influential, but also politically influential, because you also cashed your paycheck there, you did your grocery shopping at the bar. All of life was pretty much at the bar.
So there were some powerful saloon keepers, right? There's what, John Gillespie, Patty McGraw, Billy Bouchaw?
Billy Bouchaw, the foist of the foist. He was the alderman, so the ward captain for the first ward, first precinct. So this is, again, down on the Riverside, Lower East Side of Detroit, the foist of the foist. And he was in charge of collecting all of the ballots and calling and marking the ballots. And he also was very, very good at making sure that plenty of people registered their residence, their primary residence, at his tavern, which had two bedrooms. But come election day, it had at least 175 lodgers.
Ah.
Yes.
Okay. What about John Gillespie?
John Gillespie was actually, so far as I can tell, he never held a publicly elected office. But he really knew how to work the system. He was campaign manager for mayors of note, and he figured out how to buy votes, which was essentially trade jobs for votes. So you couldn't necessarily just hand over wads of cash for votes, but if you're, say, in charge of public works, then if certain people show up on one side on hiring day and certain other people show up on another side on hiring day, and a voting boss gives you the nod, then you know who to hire. So John Gillespie pretty much worked the system through all of his career.
And Paddy McGraw.
Paddy McGraw. Paddy McGraw was a good old-fashioned Irishman. He played the fiddle. He ran a brothel at the Hamtramck Detroit border.
Are we talking late 1800s?
Late 1800s up into the early 1900s, about to 1920s or so. Prohibition pretty much killed poor Paddy McGraw's business. But he was influential. He was the person for miles and miles around, and he had all of the influence with the voting and who you talked to and who you did business with.
Now, we wanted to talk about a gold medal. If you want to talk about Olympic medals, this is a gold medal level of political corruption. So take us back in your time machine to 1930 and Detroit Mayor Charles Bowles. What kind of scoundrel was Mayor Bowles?
You know, the kind of scoundrel that I really, really, really wish I could find some reason to like him, and I just can't. There's nothing redeeming about this man. He is the only Detroit mayor to ever have been recalled from public office in the history of mayors of Detroit. It took 9 months to get there, so that's how bad a guy he was. And it was 1930, so it was Prohibition and the Depression. That's how bad he was. He was elected into office essentially on the backing of the Ku Klux Klan. Well, after several attempts.
Well, there's a great calling card right there.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was he like, and what was his campaign like? Why was he such a scoundrel?
Well, he first tried for it in 1924, and that's when the KKK really kind of started taking over Southeast Michigan. And he had a lot of backing. There was a runoff election because somebody had stepped down, and he came really close and didn't quite make it. He was what they called a sticker candidate. And a sticker candidate, this is some of the vocabulary that they used to have for voting back in the day. Like we say hanging chads, they said sticker candidates. So he was a write-in candidate, but his people would hand out stickers. And one of his opponents in one of the elections for mayor was Mayor John Smith. And his people who backed him managed to convince the voters that John Smith was not his real name and he might have spelled his name wrong. So here, take this sticker and vote for Charles Bowles.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you were saying, so there was a recall election.
Yes.
Because he gets into office, and what's he like?
So phenomenally corrupt that no one really knows even how to track it. You know, the reporters are aghast. They don't know how to figure out all of the gambling rings. And there's a brothel / gambling ring that you can see from his window of his office at City Hall. It's that corrupt. Yeah.
You know, when you think of the footprint of history and things that you dig in and you find and you write about at ProhibitionDetroit.com, how does that inform the way you look at politics today?
Good and bad. I think taking a long view of it, you know, a 180-year-long view of it, in the end, we're still here and life isn't too bad. So, you know, if corruption is that rampant and that ridiculous 100 years ago, then we're doing things all right.
We survived.
Yeah.
A walk through the history of political shenanigans and trickery in Michigan history with Detroit historian Mickey Lyons. You can check out her blog at prohibitiondetroit.com. Thank you so much. It's always fun talking history with you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Coming up, back in the 1850s, an eruption from the sun's atmosphere hit our planet.
It swept over Earth, and when it crossed over, it knocked out telegraph lines for 3 days. Arcs were just sparking off of telegraph poles. Compasses were just wiggling around. The aurora was seen all the way down to the Caribbean. Now, you might ask, what would happen today? Well, we don't use the telegraph. But there have been studies by FEMA and other agencies that suggest that we could lose every transformer on the East and West Coast and not have electrical power for a few years.
But stay tuned. NASA's on a mission to touch the sun, and one of the goals is to protect Earth from future eruptions. That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Bill Harris has been a central figure in the cultural life of Detroit for a long time. The Kresge Foundation gave him their prestigious Eminent Artist Award some years ago, and his plays have been produced around the country. He's also published poetry and innovative interpretations of African American history that defy any easy categories. Our reviewer, poet Keith Taylor, thinks Harris' new book, I Got to Keep Moving, might just be his best.
I Got to Keep Moving is a collection of 25 short stories, but they're all so closely linked that the book begins to feel like a novel. There are characters and families that recur in many of the stories, but they are all connected one way or another to Harris's fictional town of Acorn, Alabama. The book starts there with plantation stories from before the Civil War, and it ends with the broken memories of the place in an old woman's mind sometime around the civil rights movement in the 1960s. But the bulk of I Gotta Keep Moving, its real emotional heart, happens in the Jim Crow South and during the slow movement of the people from Acorn up to the equally racist Midwest. The stories create a rich and diverse album of character sketches. Bill Harris does a beautiful job writing about the complex dynamics of the black communities that his characters live and work in. They are good and bad people, sympathetic and despicable, but they are all finding a way to survive in a larger cultural environment that is designed to exclude them. They have created their own world, their own culture, in which the old human drama plays out with a classical complexity. Perhaps my favorite characters in the book are Pearl and her blind child, simply known as Sun. Pearl managed a brothel while still a teenager. She becomes an advisor to a naive white woman, then the seamstress to a minstrel show, before she finds her vocation sewing for both the black and white communities in a small town. All the time, she is nurturing and protecting her gifted, special son. Harris uses the old classical idea of the blind seer or prophet to portray this boy. Sun is a singer who charms his church and the white neighborhoods where he sings to call people to buy vegetables. Their story ends, at least for this book, in a Sunday morning shootout that reads as quickly as a murder mystery. Harris finds different prose styles to tell his different stories. He can write evocative, lyrical prose when needed, or he can write quick, staccato sentences when character and action demand them. At the end, in the broken prose of the shattered memory, Bill Harris takes the readers of I Gotta Keep Moving to an emotional place that might indeed be unforgettable.
Mythology's Icarus is no match for NASA's Parker Solar Probe, its mission to touch the sun.
And last week, it broke the record and flew closer to our star than any man-made object has before. And if that's not impressive enough, it's also now moved faster than any human-made object ever has. Now, there is a Michigan tie to this important moment in space exploration, and he joined us last Thursday at our live show at Zingerman's Gray Line in Ann Arbor. Justin Casper is principal investigator for the Parker Solar Probe and a climate space scientist professor at the University of Michigan, and here is our conversation from last week.
So what is the mission of this probe?
Solar probe's pretty amazing. For more than 50 years, we've had this list of dream missions to try and do, and Parker Solar Probe, it's called now, has always been on that list. We want to send a spacecraft into the sun's atmosphere for the first time. And we just haven't had the technology to be able to do that before. Before I get into why we were able to do it, finally, why on earth would you want to do that other than, you know, that sounds fun, Icarus and all that, and we'll show him wrong. Well, there are two big mysteries. If you look at the sun, its surface is yellow. It's glowing at around 6,000 degrees the same way like your toaster wires glow when they're hot. And much to our surprise, when you look at the solar atmosphere above that surface, instead of cooling off, the temperature rises. Within about 100 kilometers, the temperature jumps up to 100,000 degrees. The sun is surrounded by an extended atmosphere we call the corona that's heated to 1 to 10 million degrees. And so we'd really like to understand what on earth is going on that superheats the sun's atmosphere.
Technology-wise, I mean, you're sending this thing off. How do you know it isn't going to just evaporate? What's the technology that let this happen?
So first, we do a lot of testing on the ground. We had to take advantage of a lot of very new materials. So the front of the spacecraft is a 10-square-meter heat shield made of a carbon foam. That can survive, you know, 3,000 degrees without anything happening. The front of it's covered in kind of synthetic sapphire crystal, very reflective, very strong. And it needs to be because at closest approach, we're reflecting something like 6 megawatts of sunlight, so enough energy to power a village. The light's so bright it would flip the spacecraft around in under a minute if we didn't actively push back against it. And so we needed these new materials to survive. We tested on the ground. Right now, the situation is where we're plunging towards the sun, and it's running autonomously. So it'll be a couple weeks before I know for sure that it made it out the other side intact.
Wow. So and just to get us a sense, how close to the sun will the probe get throughout the course of this multi-year mission?
Sure. So Earth is about 215 solar radii away from the sun. Right now, we're about 40 solar radii away from the sun, and in a few days we'll have our closest approach at 35 solar radii, and then we'll come whipping back out again. Over the next 7 years, we have 7 encounters with Venus, and each time we go by Venus, we play a little game. We slow down and we speed Venus up a little bit, and that changes our orbit so we can plunge closer and closer to the sun. So by the end of the mission, we'll be closing the less than 10 solar radii away from the sun. So practically 4% of the way from the Earth.
Amazing. Yeah. And the Parker Solar Probe has now traveled faster than, let me see if I have the figures right, 153,454 miles per hour. So the fastest ever man-made object relative to the sun. How is it moving so fast?
So the first big challenge is just getting something away from Earth and then basically slowing it down enough so it can fall towards the sun. So we had to slow down and lose as much as of Earth's speed around the sun as possible. That then let us fall towards the sun, and now it's just gravity. So it's really stunning. If you go online and look at the trajectory, you'll see it's accelerating, accelerating. It actually, while we were recording, it crossed 160,000 miles an hour. And at fastest approach, in 7 years, it'll be moving at around 430,000 miles an hour. So New York to Philadelphia in like 1 second.
Wouldn't that be great?
That's great, right? Stopping would be difficult.
Stopping might be hard. So since launch was August?
Launch was August 12th.
All right. So how has it performed? And are you going to be able to dive into all the data?
It's been fantastic. I thought when it launched, I would finally relax, but that was not the case. Basically, we took off and within a couple days, we're talking to the instruments, checking them out, powering up high voltages. And what happens is about 6 days before the encounter, the spacecraft retracts its communication dish behind the heat shield so it doesn't melt. So our instruments have to autonomously decide what to do. So we basically had 3 months to decide, okay, is everything working? Great. Let's set it up for what we think the sun will be like and make sure it's trying to capture the right observations. On Halloween at around 10 in the morning, basically a switch flipped on the spacecraft and we went into this encounter science mode, I hope. Basically, all we're getting right now is a beep coming from the spacecraft. We know it's alive and it's still working. If something goes wrong, it'll beep differently. But otherwise, we have to wait about 11 days to find out what happened.
And on tenterhooks.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Justin, I'm interested in what humankind, how will we benefit from the data that Parker Solar Probe is going to collect and send back?
So I like to think about it in terms of the basic science and then the societal applications. So from the basic science point of view, like, I'm mystified that something can heat material up to millions of degrees. I mean, I sure can't do that. And we think it has something to do with magnetic fields and waves near the sun. If we could understand why the sun's atmosphere has such an easy time doing that, you know, maybe we could figure out how to do controlled fusion, you know, the ultimate clean energy source, just to pick a really cool example of how we might apply that. In terms of practical benefit to society, you know, every now and then the solar atmosphere will throw off a massive eruption. We call these coronal mass ejections. The equivalent of all the water of Lake Michigan going from rest to moving at 3 million miles an hour in just tens of minutes. And sometimes Earth gets in the way of one of those eruptions. We had a really famous one in the 1850s. It swept over Earth, and when it crossed over, it knocked out telegraph lines for 3 days. Arcs were just sparking off of telegraph poles. Compasses were just wiggling around. The aurora was seen all the way down to the Caribbean. Now, you might ask, what would happen today? Well, we don't use the telegraph, but there have been studies by FEMA and other agencies that suggest that we could lose every transformer on the East and West Coast and not have electrical power for a few years.
Whoa.
And that's just not survivable. Yeah, so what we're trying to do is figure out how to build a predictive model, the same way we're getting better at saying this hurricane might make landfall, maybe in this area. If we could say this eruption is heading towards us, we should probably power down the electrical grid. You know, we could avoid a real disaster.
Now, you mentioned 7 years.
Yep.
Is that the lifespan? I mean, what is it that's going to end this mission?
So if all goes well, we should be fine at the end of the 7 years. The spacecraft controls it's solar-powered, amazingly. So that actually took a lot of work. The original idea is it was going to be nuclear-powered. But what we do is we pump water through the back of the solar panels, and we just extend the edges of the solar panels out to collect sunlight at closest approach. When we're further from the sun, we extend the solar panels out more. That provides more electricity. And then actually it warms the water so it doesn't freeze. So it's a very delicate interplay. So we won't run out of power. We need fuel to push back against just the pressure of the light as we approach the sun. And so if everything goes fine, in the end, one day what'll happen is, as we approach the sun each time, we spin up a big wheel to counteract the pressure of the light. And then we fire a rocket every now and then so we can slow the wheel down again. If we run out of fuel, and we have a lot of fuel, so that's good, but one day if we run out of fuel, we won't be able to slow down that wheel. The spacecraft will flip around, and it would take less than a second to incinerate the normal part of the spacecraft. It couldn't handle those temperatures.
And that will be... Oh, yeah.
But that could be tens of years from now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why?
Knock on wood.
Why did you become a space scientist? What drew you to space?
Oh, wow. Well, for me personally, every generation has their stories. I mean, the Sputnik generation, that's a wonderful story. For me, it was unfortunately watching Challenger. So I was one of those fourth graders who was in a cafeteria watching live. And it was, you know, very disturbing, right? But I became fascinated in this thought of using robots to supplement human exploration. I love the space shuttle. I love human exploration. But I just got really into this thought of, like, well, maybe for these really extreme environments, we can send a robot first. And, you know, for some reason, I never came up with anything better to do. So here I find myself today.
And so how does what you're doing, here you are, the chance to be lead investigator with the Parker Solar Probe, how does that compare with the dreams you had when you were that fourth grader watching and starting to think of space?
It's like kind of the same. I mean, it's amazing. I have a four-year-old now, and I watch what he says. Sorry, a three-year-old. I watch what he says he wants to do because I'm like, you know, he might take him seriously. He might wind up doing this. So maybe in 40 years, he'll be a firefighter, Superman, ambulance operator. Well, yeah, it's been a wild journey.
Well, indeed. Well, we will be all watching, and I know we'll be hearing from you as stuff starts coming in, and we count on hearing good reports of the Parker Solar Probe doing what you sent it to do. Justin Casper, U of M Climate Space Science Professor and lead investigator for NASA's Parker Solar Probe. Thank you for sharing your passion.
Great to be
with
here.
Us. Thank you. In his recent story for Crane's Detroit Business, reporter Chad Livengood notes, in Michigan's last 10 midterm elections, so we're going back to 1978, voter turnout has topped 50% only once. And that was 2006, when Jennifer Granholm and Dick DeVos were vying to become governor. One way to boost voter participation? Time off from work, paid time off. The Commonwealth Heritage Group, Inc. is going all in on helping employees vote today. Everybody gets the day off. Andy Weir is president of the Commonwealth Heritage Group, headquartered in Dexter with a regional office in Traverse City. Andy, tell us a bit about your company.
Well, we do archaeological and historical services, which basically means that anything that has any federal or state permitting or funding has to make sure they're not disturbing anything archaeologically or historically significant.
So how many employees, how many offices, and how many states?
We have 11 offices in 9 states. We're mainly centered in the upper Midwest, but we have a bunch of offices on the East Coast and one in Utah. We have about 60 full-time employees. Our payroll in the summer months and right now is about 110 because we're field work based. So we have a lot of seasonal employees.
So we would consider you a small business?
Yeah, absolutely. We're a 100% small business.
And everyone is off today?
Everyone is off today unless there's a client deadline that couldn't be negotiated or moved.
And this is paid time off to go vote?
Yep, absolutely. It's time off that they can use today. They can't bank it. Everything's been suspended. If they can do it and still meet their client deadlines, they can have the whole day off.
So, Andy, this is costing money. Most work is not happening today. Why do this?
Well, we are a company of highly educated people, and I know my employees are very political active. But I don't have a whole lot of say in the larger political arena, but I have this little bit of power to send this message out how important it is to vote. So I know my employees will most likely be voting, but if they can send the message to their friends, to their relatives, that's so important to vote, that's why I wanted to do it. I wanted just to reinforce how important it is for everybody to vote.
Why this election, Andy?
It's just the country is so polarized right now that I think that we just need to make sure everybody knows what's at stake and how important their voice is. So, and the only way that the majority of us normal people can exercise their voice is through voting.
Now, how had you handled voting day in previous years?
We kind of have a flex time system where people can come in late, work late. Take a longer lunch and make up the time. That's traditionally how we handle election days.
But this was the year to say everybody gets to vote today and you get the day off.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm hoping to do it from here on out. I would love to see it be a national holiday where everybody gets it off. But I'm hoping not just because I think this is a really important midterm election. I'm hoping to always give my employees the day off on election day, presidential or midterms.
Chad Livengood's piece for Crane's notes that company-wide holidays on election day are less common outside of government or companies that have big unionized workforces. What is your message to other company owners, companies like yours?
My message would be that you have to really seize the opportunities that you have. And if you have the opportunity to spread the message of how important it is to vote, do it. Give your employees the time off. Give them the ability to make the time to go vote. It's just going to empower your employees, empower the people to really make their voices heard.
Andy Weir is president of Commonwealth Heritage Group, where all employees have the day off to vote. Andy, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Joy Horan, Sarah Leeson, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.